Wow, that is bright. Good afternoon, everybody. Everybody all sleepy now from having lunch? How was it? All right? Oh, I got some cheers. All right. My name is Brian Day. I'm a senior program manager on what we call the customer adoption team within the Exchange Product Group, and we're going to spend the next 75 minutes talking about not your typical deployment session where you probably expect to see a bunch of clicking through wizards and installing servers and such. We're going to give you a little bit of a different flavor. So first, when we were putting this thing together, marketing said you really need kind of a, you know, an opening preamble slide here. So we came up with a bit of a literal sense. So we, the admins of Contoso, in order to form a more perfect collaboration, maintain support, ensure internal compliance, provide for the common end user, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of Perry to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this deployment project for Exchange. Marketing, don't ask for things so literal. So what are we actually going to do today? We're going to talk a little bit about some of the different areas and stages in deployment where you might not always think all the way through. So these are the things that often come into our team we see as kind of speed bumps along the way to getting a nice, healthy, strong deployment. There's also going to be a large number of callouts to other sessions that are going on during this week. The idea being that it's quite a long list of sessions that we're offering to you this week, and we want to make sure that you're aware of the customers in this room going through deployment or thinking about deployment. What are some of the more interesting ones that perhaps you want to jump onto that maybe the name or the description of the session actually doesn't tell you some of the interesting bits you'd learn inside of it? So if we kind of do a quick poll in here, who's already doing deployments today in 2013? Oh, a healthy number of you. How many of you are just starting to think about it? More, okay. And who's running on, let's start with 2010. Wow, that's nice, okay. 2007, still pretty healthy. Who's brave enough to talk about 2003? All right, good. We're not going to even bother going back further than that. All right. So, as you're going through a deployment, what are the different phases that you might actually walk through? If you talk to our folks in MCS, there's five different phases during every MCS product migration that you'd see. So first is the envisioning phase, really talking about, let's define and analyze what the actual requirements of our deployment are going to be, right? We want to migrate, but what do we need to actually do to make sure that it's a successful migration? Develop, you know, high-level design of what we think it might look like. Then you turn into the planning stage. You start to actually develop the detailed design, start to really turn the knobs and pull the levers to figure out what we really expect to do as far as this migration goes. You move on to build. This is when you start to do your test lab and maybe some real high-level designs where you start to think about pilots and such as you roll into the stability phase. And then finally, at the end, you roll off. Everything's done. You've moved all your users over. And you transition off to the operational team to take care of your baby for the next few years until it's time to repeat. So we're going to look at, you know, kind of the more common idea. So maybe you've got Exchange 2010 today. We're going to talk about some of the things you'll run into as you do, you know, the most simple migration, a couple of internet sites, internet-facing, non-internet-facing. You introduce Exchange 2013, and you swing the namespace over. So we're going to kind of focus on those areas. We're not going to talk about design. We're not going to talk about those best practices. Ross already covered a lot of the architecture stuff in the session before this. So if you didn't catch that, by all means, go and listen to the recording. If you are more interested in some of the design philosophies, go see our friend Boris. He's got an actual session on design concepts and best practices that is going to be held on Wednesday. I'm sure he would love to entertain any questions that you may have as far as that go. So before we actually get into deployment, what do we have to think about doing? There's a number of tools that Microsoft makes available that all of you should be at least thinking of and considering using as you go through your different phases of a deployment. During design, during concept, during stabilization, making sure that you've actually deployed a system that is going to be able to handle what you need it to handle. So the very first one, which, show of hands, who's actually heard of the Exchange Server Deployment Assistant today? All right, so it's actually a little more than we thought were going to raise their hands, because this is a tool that we've been putting a lot of love into, and it doesn't seem to get as used as often as we think it would. So we're going to go through a short demo of that for probably about the 30 to 40% of you, I think, in the room that didn't raise their hands and show you what that looks like. There's also the Exchange Best Practice Analyzer, which you guys have used for years. as well as the remote connectivity analyzer to make sure that your system is not only healthy before you start your migration, but also healthy once you finish your migration as well. So let's step a little deeper into the deployment assistant itself. There's a number of scenarios that this thing can help you with. And when you launch this website, it essentially asks you a small number of questions. I think it's five or less, depending on which options you pick. And it's going to give you a really excellent checklist of, okay, so you've told me what kind of Exchange deployment you have. You've told me what kind you'd like to get to. Here are all the things that you're going to do along your journey. PowerShell examples, all the TechNet content pulled into one central location, put into a nice clean PDF file. You can see the different scenarios right now that we covered today. We've got a number of cloud scenarios as well, if you want to think about Office 365 hybrid or migrating to it entirely. But there's a ton of on-premises information in there as well. Now, who here in the audience loves on-premises still? Ah, I love it. Okay, good. So do I. All right. Let's see here. So aka.ms/exdeploy, that is where you can access the tool. It is a web-based tool, so it's not something that you'll be downloading. There was a similarly named tool back in Exchange 2010's days that you actually downloaded and ran on your local systems. This is entirely a browser-based tool. So let's take a quick look at it. It won't take too long. All right, so when you go to the exdeploy short URL that I had up there before, it's going to bring you to this page here. Real simple, nice big orange button for you to click. You've got all the scenarios that we currently support in the tool listed there for you. But we launch the tool itself, and it's going to ask you, well, what are we talking about? Are we doing on-premises, which is first, notice that, that's awesome, hybrid in the middle, or cloud only all the way to the other side? So if we're just talking about on-premises, I would click that. Okay, where do we want to get? We still have the 2010 information in there because there's still a lot of people in the middle of deciding where they want to go. Are they ready for 2013? Do they want to stick with 2010 for now? So we'll go with 2013. What are we actually doing? Is it a new installation? The green field we all wish we could work on, right? More often than not, you're going to be choosing one of the other options. So we'll say the most complicated one. I hit next. Are we going to be doing client access and mailbox on the same server or not? So this is the multi-role or single-role question. Everybody in this room is going to do multi-role, right? So we'll just say same server. Yes, we still support disjoint namespaces. This always comes up in every release. Are you still going to support disjoint namespaces? Are you still going to support single-label domains? For now, the answer is yes, but we are not running one as far as this demonstration goes. Do we have edge transport? Yes or no? Pretty straightforward. So we'll say yeah, why not? Make it as complex as can be. That's it. We've answered all the questions that the tool actually needs. Very straightforward. You can get through that in about 5 seconds if you weren't doing a demo. What happens at that point is you get this really cool page you can walk through either online, and it's got you all sorts of information. If you look over, and I'll zoom in so you can see a little better. All right, we've got prerequisites, disabling IPv6 on 2007 servers in very certain scenarios that you might not normally realize you have to do, actually installing 2013, configuring it, etc. And this page will actually remember where you were while you were working with it. So if you close the browser and you come back later, there was a cookie saved locally so that you can then get back to exactly where you were. Now let's say that you wanted to share this. Well, up here in the upper right-hand corner, simple download button, right? You can actually print this thing off to use it later, print it out if you want to, and it'll give you a nice PDF file that walks you through everything you need to know. This one here with the options that we chose was 32 pages in length, and you can just read this until you pass out in the middle of the night. All sorts of information in here. So it's a tool that we hope a lot of people that already know will continue to use. We keep putting more and more investment into it. I believe we're going to have some of the multi-force scenarios that people are starting to ask us about. The team is working on getting those into the tool in a future date. So please, please remember that tool exists. All right. EXBPA, right? We love this tool. We've used this since Exchange 2003 to catch the little things that we might not notice going wrong in the environment. We've heard loud and clear that you demand this tool come back for Exchange 2013. So the good news is, here's one of the sessions. Go and visit with Mark Kinneen. He's got a session on Tuesday that is going to introduce the next generation of EXBPA. So you'll once again have EXBPA to run your 2013 environments, and the old tool still exists for 2010 and before. So hopefully you guys will be very pleased to see that coming back. Moving on, we have the remote connectivity analyzer. This is big just to understand, are we actually healthy as we start out today? There's nothing worse than going into a deployment that somebody has already started, they've switched their namespace over, and things are just going crazy. And they immediately assume what? That it was 2013 that did it, or back in 2010, it was 2010 that did it. One of the best things that you can do is make sure that you're actually healthy before you do anything in your environment. That could be as simple as running through, you know, EXRCA, taking all the different tests. Is AutoDiscover working? Because that's going to be hypercritical for 2013. Is Outlook Anywhere working today? Inbound, outbound SMTP, is it doing what we expect it to? Make sure everything is at a nice base state before you do anything. And then keep running it as you go. Make sure that the changes you have done have not impacted the environment in a negative way to some degree. If you would like to, there's also a downloadable version of this tool. So the normal web tool runs off of Microsoft Data Center and connects into your on-premises environment. You can go to that client tab up at the top if you want to be able to download the tool locally and run some of the connectivity tools inside your organization or back to Office 365, say, to make sure you have clean connectivity back to the service if you're a hybrid or pure cloud customer. So test connectivity at Microsoft.com is where you can find it. That's another one that we continually update, and I know with some of the information that we're releasing this week, we're also going to be updating this tool to be able to do things like test MAPI or HTTP, right? That's the new connectivity model in 2013 that Ross probably talked about earlier today. The tool will be updated to be able to test that at a later time. So what else should we be thinking about? Well, if we're going to start designing something, we have to kind of know what we need, right, or what we have. So there's the Server Profile Analyzer, which at this point in time, you could only use it for 2007 or 2003, since it was web dev based. And there's also the Exchange 2013 Server Role Calculator. That calculator is not necessarily just for trying to determine how much hardware we need and where we need to deploy it. That calculator is also very good if you look at the tabs that it comes with. It's showing you, you know, kind of what some of the failure scenarios are. Being able to fail certain data centers or fail the WAN or fail certain servers to see what's going to happen in your environment to understand, is the model that we have chosen to go with for this deployment the correct one for us? Does it hit all the areas that we need to make sure we get covered as part of this upgrade? We have a couple of sessions that are going to touch on these tools. So Jeff has a planning session or sizing session coming up on Tuesday. So he will lightly touch on the calculator as well as go through some of the other tools that he is very heavily involved with. And we also have a tips and tricks session that I'm giving on Wednesday as well to try and show some of the nuances of this tool that often get missed during engagements with customers. We're also going to touch on three other scripts that are up there. So there's the message stat script, get log file usage, and the processor query tool. Three more really important tools that if you've not heard their name already, I would strongly suggest that either come attend the session if you don't have something it's overlapping with, or watch. Actually, it's an interactive, so I don't think it's going to be recorded. So send one of your friends if you can't make it. There's yet more, right? Load gen and jet stress. Again, this is the week where you're going to get a lot more information than you probably ever find on TechNet. So these tools are, or jet stress itself is a best effort support tool. But we have people here this week that could really give you in-depth information on this tool to make sure you understand how you're testing your storage solution before you start to do your full deployment of Exchange. So definitely a couple of areas there that you certainly want to think about attending if you have the time. Yes, we're still going, right? We have more, right? This is the week that Neil Johnson is going to unveil version 2 of the Client Network Connectivity Bandwidth Calculator. That's a mouthful. So if you have the time again, go check out Neil. My clicker wants me closer, right? So on Wednesday, Neil's going to be giving a session on that. Very important tool to understand if you're doing, say, multi-data center deployments of Exchange, how is that going to tax the bandwidth in our environment? Because maybe this is the first time you're going with a multi-data center deployment. You've never really taxed your WAN internally with the amount of traffic the clients can generate across different sites. Or maybe it's your replication traffic you're wondering what's going to happen, where the server calculator itself can help with that. So now that we've kind of touched on a lot of the different tools that you guys really should be thinking about and hopefully using during a deployment, where do we actually start? Right, where do I need to be before I can do anything? So Active Directory. Not a lot has changed as far as the requirements. These are pretty much the same requirements as 2010 when it was released. You still need writable domain controllers. You still need at least one writable, that should say global catalog, in each Active Directory site that Exchange is deployed in. You need to at least be on Server 2003, Service Pack 2 or higher, which by 2014, I really hope you're at least on that or higher. You can also use 2012 R2. We'll talk about that in a moment, what requirements are there. And your forest functional level has to be at least at Windows Server 2003. So just like 2010, these particular requirements have not changed. Exchange support matrix. That is the single source of truth for what is supported as far as domain forest function, forest functional level and domain functional levels for Active Directory, right? Or what versions of Exchange can we actually install on what versions of Windows Server, et cetera. We just recently updated it for the information with Service Pack 1 and the other RUs that came out for 2007 and 10. We have also worked with the UA folks to consolidate. There used to be a page for each version of Exchange. We've now consolidated it down, so you can go to that one URL and in one place have the newest version of everything you need for 7, 10, and 13. OSs. So we got a lot of options now. You can use Server 2008 R2. Works great with Service Pack 1 on it. It will have a few more prerequisites or hot fixes that you need to install before installing 2013. But also, you can consider Server 2012 or now Server 2012 R2. If you're going to use 2012 R2, you do have to be using at least Service Pack 1. We do not support that with Cumulative Update 3 or anything before that. If you're going to use 2012 or R2, there's another decision you can make. Do I want to use Standard Edition or Data Center Edition? Because in 2012, Windows Failover Clustering is included in both SKUs. You no longer have to buy the more expensive one just to get Failover Clustering. So now even your DAG servers could be on 2012 or 2012 R2 Standard Edition, and you still get all the functionality that you need. .NET Framework 4.5. 4.5 is the minimum requirement. That is what setup will look for. We would strongly suggest that you install 4.5.1 if you can. There have been a significant number of fixes in there that will help 2013 with a few stability and performance issues going forward. You may even see that 4.5.1 becomes a requirement down the road not too far. Windows Management Framework 3, so you can get PowerShell 3 installed, as well as the UCMA 4.0 package. And like usual, there's a number of IIS features that you have to install as well for Exchange so that the mailbox role in 2013 will be able to serve up EAC, OAuth, everything that you might expect. So going back and touching on 2012 R2 for a moment. Oh, it worked. Look at that. All right. So 2013 Service Pack 1 is pretty much the best story, right? So we've got all three here. All right, we can install on it. You can use the domain function and forest functional level at 2012 R2. And you can also run against just the domain controllers themselves. That's often a big question that comes in that says, well, look, you haven't stated support for the functional levels yet, but is it okay if I just deploy the domain controllers? Is that going to hurt anything? That comes in a lot. That was a really hot topic over the last few months, and now we're happy to say that with 2013 Service Pack 1, yep, go nuts. We're okay with the 2012 R2 domain controllers just being there, or if you've actually upgraded your whole forest, increasing the levels themselves. So, almost. So CU3, and it's not quite the same, right? We've got support for the domain controllers to be 2012 R2, running at a 2012 or lower functional level, but you can't install on it and you can't run at the higher functional levels. For completeness, all right, so we got 2010 SP3 RU5 or later. As you can see there, we're okay with the domain controllers and we're also okay with the highest functional level, but you can't install on it. And our friend 2007, very similar to CU3, we're okay with the domain controllers existing at that level, but you can't install on, you cannot install on it and you can't run the highest level of the functional levels. Pretty clear? All right, moving on. Clients. Office 365 Pro Plus. Now, this is the subscription version of Outlook, if we want to look at it like that. We recommend the latest bits. You're going to see there's a trend here. 2013, 10, 7, and, well, 3 is not supported. But for the three versions of Outlook still supported, we do recommend that you stay up to date on the latest service pack and the latest public update that the Office team has released. There was a very important release for Outlook 2013 recently. Where if you had, I believe, somewhere in the November, December, January range, There was an update that went out that if you moved a mailbox, their profile wouldn't update. So you suddenly had a user with a corrupt profile after moving their mailbox in 2013. So a patch just came out. I believe it was the March 2014 update for Outlook 2013. Make sure you're on that or later and you'll have no problems moving a profile. Well, I should never say never, right? But it'll be a much better experience. There's always gremlins hiding out there. If you're using any of the other clients, so let's say the older Entourage 2008, right? You need to make sure that has been updated to the Web Services Edition, which if you're coming from 2010, you would have already done this. Outlook for Mac 2011, also supported. The browser recommendations you can see below, that's where you're going to get the best experience. Now, it says recommendation. It's not the minimums. There are lower versions of those browsers that are supported, but we would recommend at least getting to the latest or N-1 version of those browsers to make sure you have the best experience possible, whether that is in the on-premises product or even in the service itself. Now, we have a very important date coming up next week. On April 8th, we're no longer going to be supporting Exchange Server 2003. No claps or anything? I'm surprised. There we go. So Server 2003 finally is going to be ending its support, right? Extended support is going to end for that. And Server 2003 cannot coexist with 2013, which you've probably already heard. So if you have 2003 in your environment, setup will not even run to install the server. Setup won't even let you extend the schema if it sees Server 2003 in your forest. So you would have to think about a cross-forest migration or get everybody off of Server 2003 before going forward. Similarly, we also have Exchange 2010 Service Pack 2 going out of support next week. So easier on that one. You just have to upgrade to Service Pack 3, and you'll be fine. But just keep that in mind that if, I still got Service Pack 2 running all over the place. If you don't upgrade after next week, it might get a little more interesting if you run into issues that we've already fixed later on in Service Pack 3 if you call into support. All right. So we've already talked about what clients you should have. We've talked about what browsers you should have. We've talked about Active Directory and what OSs the servers themselves could run. You also have to prepare the environment. This should be very similar to what you've done the last few versions of Exchange if you've been in the Exchange world for a number of years. So we need to coexist with, and I'm going to make a note here, it says 2010 Service Pack 3 RU5 or later. That's a recommendation, and yes, it's the latest update. It's not the minimum requirement, but it's the recommended one right now. Specifically with RU5, you needed that update to be able to do an edge subscription to a 2013 Service Pack 1 server. Same thing with 2007 you see there, Service Pack 3 RU13 or later, that's the same deal there. You need RU13 or later to be able to do an edge subscription with 2013. If you have edge transport servers, legacy ones, 2010 or 7, specifically 2010, if you have one of those guys in the environment, and you may have updated it from Service Pack 2 to Service Pack 3 like a year and a half ago, when you run 2013 setup, it's not going to know that it's running at Service Pack 3 unless you have recreated the Edge subscription. Because it's only when you recreate the Edge subscription that we increment the version in Active Directory's configuration partition. You have to do that so that 2013 will say, oh, okay, you do have Service Pack 3 everywhere. I'll go ahead and install. So if you're running setup and it's yelling at you that Service Pack 3 is not everywhere and you're looking at your servers, it might be the Edge server subscription that you need to go and update to make sure setup sees that. You'll have to prepare your schema. We've done that for every major version of Exchange and pretty much every Service Pack that I know of. If you have not yet deployed Service Pack 3 for 2010, you can get into this odd little thing where, okay, we just want to extend our schema once, right? Because those are always cumulative. You can extend the schema to the latest version. It'll give you everything that we've released before that. The problem is if you go to do that, but you've not deployed SP3 for 2010 yet, what happens? Setup goes, oh, you don't have SP3 yet, and it just bombs out. So you'll actually have to go and deploy Service Pack 3 for 2010 first, get that everywhere, make sure any Edge servers are updated as well, redo the subscription if necessary. Then you'll be able to extend the schema for 2013. So it might be a double hop there if you're not already on SP3. Like usual, we then have to go and prepare Active Directory, get the organization updated to the latest Exchange version, go and prepare our domains so that if we have a multi-domain forest, we then go and prepare all the domains that might have global catalogs Exchange uses, you might deploy Exchange servers in, or it might have mail-enabled objects. When you run prepare AD, it's going to prepare the local domain for you. So you'll only have to do the prepared domains part if you have multiple domains in your forest. Before you install your first server, something to be aware of, and this catches people off guard, is that 2013 creates a new offline address book. And it makes it the default. You're welcome. All right, so what's going to happen is your clients are going to start saying, oh, I got a new default offline address book, and I don't have a copy of this sucker yet, so I'm going to download the whole thing. Now, if it's a relatively small environment, that might really not be a big deal. At Microsoft, our offline address book is approaching 700 megabytes. We have a lot of certificates in our offline address book. So when you think about how many employees we have, multiply that by 700 megabytes, think what Monday morning might be like when everybody comes in, fires up Outlook, and starts downloading the new offline address book. So to get around this, what you can do is, before installing your first 2013 servers, and it's the mailbox role that will do it, in case you're curious, go to all your legacy databases and set your existing offline address book as the default one at the database level. That way you're protecting them so that the next time the user comes in and opens Outlook, or the next 24-hour cycle goes by and Outlook looks for its public folder, offline address book, it'll say, oh, it's the same one I've been using. I'll just go get my differential files and we'll be okay. Or if you hadn't done that, they'll say, oh, well, we got this new 2013 one I got to go get, and that's a 700 meg download in our case. So be aware of that. You want to take care of this before you install your first servers. When you do get around to deploying your first servers, here's the new UI. There's also the command line. The only change, if you haven't seen the Service Pack 1 setup yet, you'll see the edge rule tick boxes there now. All right, so that's the only change in the UI version for the GUI installation. You will need to install both roles before you can do anything of any value. Reason being, it's the mailbox role that actually does all the enumeration of the Exchange Administration Center. It's also where the PowerShell commandlets are executed. So if you only install CAS, you have nowhere to actually proxy your commands back to, nor do you have anything that is going to generate the EAC pages for you to log into and manage the environment. So if you want to be able to do any environmental management, you need both roles installed first. So just keep that in mind. Just go and download the latest cumulative update. So right now we're at Service Pack 1, so that's the latest. But no longer do you have to go and download, say, 2010. Let's say 2010 Service Pack 3, you download that, you install that, and then you'd have to install the roll-up update afterwards, which could be another 30 or 45 minutes. Now you just go get whatever the latest cumulative update is. So when our next cumulative update comes out, which will be CU5, which might sound a little weird, right? But Service Pack 1 was pretty much CU4, so we're going to just continue the numbering. So 5 will come after SP1. It's not going to be Service Pack 1, CU1, like we did in 2010 and 2007. So just go get those latest bits. You can do an upgrade or fresh installation right from there. We still have the command line if you prefer it. I'm a command line junkie, so I'll drop down to the command line, do all my installation, and watch it go in there. There has been a slight change. Go ahead and groan if you want to. So we're all suffering the same pain in our labs. Every time you install Exchange now, you've got this real long /I accept Exchange server license terms that you have to actually put into the command so that Exchange will install. No longer is it like the, hey, just wait for 10 seconds and that'll be acceptance. We actually make you put it in now. Unfortunately, there is no short like /IAESLT. We certainly tried, but our lawyers didn't want that. So you've got that guy to be aware of. After the fact, once you've got the servers installed, let's say you install a multi-role box, because Brian said you had to install two roles to be able to manage anything. You can't remove a single role. That's different. In 2010 and 7, we allowed you to do that. But in 2013, we've decided that it didn't make sense. Not a lot of customers utilized it. It caused a lot of support issues. Now it's very easy to, now you actually have to uninstall Exchange if you have a multi-role box. But let's say you just wanted CAS on it. If you did the multi-role install just for management purposes, and then you said, okay, I want to take mailbox off of that, you have to uninstall and reinstall with just the CAS role. You won't be able to remove just the mailbox role in that instance. All right. Now, after your first server is installed, there's one thing every Exchange administrator hates, right? Your program's going great. Everything's on time. All your designs are done. You kick off the installation, and suddenly you go from looking like that guy to looking like this guy, because what happens? This guy shows up, right? The certificate prompt. What did we do? What did we forget to get that dreaded certificate prompt when Outlook opens or Outlook does its next auto-discover query, et cetera? When you see this, there's a number of things that probably happen, right? So Outlook now in 2013 is all HTTP based. So almost anything, whether it's Outlook Anywhere, Appier HTTP, Autodiscover, AWS, Offline Address Book, are going to make calls to URLs. And if that certificate is the default certificate on the server, when it was the self-signed cert, when you installed Exchange, Outlook's going to throw a prompt up and warn you about it. So what can we do about that? What can we do to make our life a little easier? Make sure your sites and subnets in Active Directory are properly defined. This is very, very common to go into a customer and see that their site definitions are from 5, 10 years ago. They don't necessarily match what they are today. Their subnets are either not there at all, or they've just put like a giant 10/8 in there, and everybody's in one giant site. Exchange is very site-specific when it comes to how things work. So make sure first that you've got your sites defined properly and the Exchange servers in their proper sites. That little MS Exchange server site field is the actual field on the server object itself that says what site it is in. And Exchange will update that value if you move the server from one site to another. Install CAS into a deployment site. Create a little Active Directory site that you just use for throwing Exchange into temporarily. That's perfectly fine. Put a particular range of IPs in that, a little /29 or /30 subnet, something like that. You just have a few IPs for deployment. The server sits in that site, and you can let it sit there off to the side. Mail flow is not going to touch it. You can get all your virtual directories updated so that their URLs are correct. You can get the certificate installed and basically get that server in a pristine condition before you move it into the production site itself. Make sure your auto-discover site scope and the auto-discover service internal URI values are correct. These are very often overlooked. Either the site scopes are only, in my case here, I've got Boston and Austin and Seattle sites. What if I had no users in those sites, right? The user's Outlook client fires up and it says, well, I got no Exchange servers here, so I'll just go pick the oldest SAP object in Active Directory, right? Because it's sorted by when created, when AD returns the search response. So make sure that you've actually gone in and updated your SAP objects so that they include all the sites that actually have users in it, so that you can direct the user traffic for auto-discover to the proper load balance name that you've put in into service. Also make sure that they're pointing to a load balance name on the URI field, because that will be the FQDN of the server by default. And that is one of the areas where very commonly we see people say, oh, you need to have the FQDN of the server on the certificate. No, you don't, because you probably missed one of either the URI value or one of the virtual directory values is still set to the actual FQDN of the server. And that's why you get these random pop-ups every now and then. So make sure your sites are correct. Make sure your URLs are all using load balance names, correct ones at that. Minimize the time that your virtual directory is at the defaults. Sounds obvious, right? But I can't tell you how many times myself, I'm sitting there typing away, all right, I got ActiveSync done, I got Outlook Anywhere done, I got OWA done, I got ECP done, even though we call it EAC today. We got EWS done, et cetera. And I've made a typo somewhere, probably multiple, right? Script it. That's my suggestion. Go out there, write a little 10-line PowerShell script that just goes and sets the values for you. Maybe all you do is you name the thing, set virtual directory space, you give it the CAS name, it takes that in as a variable and sets them for you. Take the human error out of it. What else might happen? So you're used to mail flow, right? Exchange in a multi-site environment has a lot of options as far as mail flow is concerned. Hub Transport and the different sites are going to send mail to one site to another, and they really don't care what Hub Transport server they pick on the other site. It's not version specific when it's site to site. So you got your mail flow going, and you go and you drop in your first Exchange servers, or 2013 servers, I should say. New options. Well, what could possibly happen here? You might not expect it at first. You might suddenly see traffic is flowing through that mailbox server now, because the 2010 Hub Transport servers in the other Active Directory site now see there's another valid Hub Transport service running in the other site it needs to get the mail to. It will very happily pick a 2013 mailbox server to send that mail to, even if you're sitting there just getting the thing configured and ready to go. That's fine. That's mail flow. We're okay with that. But be aware of the fact that that might be going on. So if you suddenly see mail going through it, yeah, that's normal. If you want to avoid this, install those servers in a different Active Directory site. Keep them off to the side. Then the other servers will not choose them as another target transport server. Certificates. Who likes doing certificates? A couple sadistic hands went up. That's great. Okay. So certificates in 2013 have been revamped a little bit. We've gone and done another end-to-end certificate wizard that is accessed through the Exchange Admin Center. You can import and export the certificate with the private key right from the web UI itself, as well as assign what services you want that certificate to use right from within the management UI. EAC is going to also throw up warnings if you have certificates in the environment starting to expire. Right, about a month out, you're going to log on to EAC and you're going to start seeing these warnings up in the corner. Hey, this server over here has a certificate that's going to expire on this day. You might want to think about doing something about that. The closer you get to expiration date, it'll actually start to warn you every single day and every single time that you log on to the box. All right. When it comes to certificates, one of the things that we always say is keep the number of certificates to a minimum. And in 2013, there's added value here. Because if you have the same certificate with the same private key being run on all CAS within the same site resiliency name, so I've got two physical data centers using the same mail.contoso.com. Well, if I have a client connection that for some reason or another gets moved from one CAS to another, if I already have the same private key at those same CAS, we actually can re-log on without the user having to put their creds in, because we store a cookie on the client side basically saying, you're logged on, here's an encrypted cookie, and it's the keys of the certificate that are used to make those cookies. So then when you hand that cookie off to a different CAS, even though you weren't logged on to it 5 minutes ago, it is able to take that cookie and with the private key that it holds, decrypts it and sees, oh, Brian was already logged on his mailbox, so don't give him the auth page, just let him keep on going through. So that's an excellent reason to have at least the same certificate on each of your multi-site URLs in the environment. Use a SAN certificate, right? Put lots of names in that SAN certificate, as many as you can before you have to go and buy another certificate. Now, there might be cost implications. I can't speak to what your different certificate authorities would charge you to do this, but we would strongly suggest you use SAN certs where possible. You can use split DNS where possible. Right, if you're going to use the same host names and the same authentication types internally and externally, you might have a very small certificate. Might only have three or four names on it. If you want to do different authentication internally versus externally, you might have different names. You might have mail.contoso.com and mail.corp.contoso.com. So now you've got two names that end up going to maybe a reverse proxy on the outside and direct to the load balancer on the inside, and outside folks maybe are using basic authentication and internal folks are maybe using NTLM or Kerberos. You don't need the machine names on the certificate. The only spot where you might need them is if you're doing unified messaging, because the telephony system will be redirected direct to the mailbox server. If that's the case, you might have to have another certificate specifically for the UM service that has the mailbox server names on it as well, which is a fantastic opportunity just to use an internal CA so that you don't have to go out and buy another certificate from a certificate authority that has all of your mailbox server names on it. If you're using a wildcard certificate, the top screenshot is what you probably were doing in 2010 and 2007. 2013, you have to go a little further and configure both of the Outlook providers so that you have the dynamically generated settings in AutoDiscovery giving back the client the proper MSSTD value. Because in 2013, when AutoDiscover gets its query and makes its response to the end user, they're dynamically generated now based off of both the EXCH and the EXPR settings, depending on if it's the internal settings or the external settings for the user. All right. In the sake of time, we'll go past the demo for now and come back to it if we have time. So the namespace switch overnight, right? This is the night that everybody gets panicky about. This is when we start doing things in DNS to make sure all the traffic is moved from pointing at 2007 or 10 off to 2013. So it's this evening, right? You've got your setup. Exchange is already there. Maybe people on the inside are already testing with host files and, you know, doing a pilot test. And then we're simply going to start moving the URLs so that they point directly to 2013. So what are some of the things that we can do to make that night easier? First, we want to mention, because it's not shown on that slide, is that for Exchange 2007, and that should say URL, not I's. It's a lowercase L, I promise you. Whether it is OWA, EWS, or OAB, those are the three settings that we suggest you should be using legacy URLs for. Right? EWS is version specific, O is version specific, and we still at the moment recommend that you use 2007 to download 2007 offline address books. Everything else can be proxied through 2013. These three applications right here you want to use for the legacy URL that you probably saw during Ross's architecture presentation. So when we do switch over, very handy to do, If your namespace switch overnight requires the change of an IP address, internally or publicly, drop the TTL on the DNS records. Go and look. The DNS zone that they're in might have a 24-hour default on it. Drop those values to something nice and small, 5, 10 minutes, so that if something does go wrong during the transition, you can easily roll back to where you were before. Very easy thing to do. As mentioned before, test with the remote connectivity analyzer before you do anything. If something's not working, let's fix that first, and then we'll put off the namespace switch over for a few more days. Reconfigure your virtual directory settings. When you switch over the namespace, you need to make sure that AutoDiscover is going to hand out the proper URLs for things like, you know, EWS and offline address books, as just mentioned. So in 2007's case, since we can't proxy those values and we have to give them a 2007 specific URL, have that script, as I mentioned, ready to configure all the 2007 virtual directories as quick as possible. Reconfigure Outlook Anywhere. We're going to get into what that means. You may need to enable Outlook Anywhere on more CAS than you had to in the past. We'll get into more detail. If you did that temporary deployment site for Exchange, don't forget to move the server back into the production site. Also make sure when you do that, that you update the service connection point to have the proper AutoDiscover site scope values on it, because it will not dynamically update if you move the server from one site to another. Update your publishing methods, whether you're using load balancers, reverse proxies, etc. If you need to, you know, move the rules to point from this IP to this IP where 2013 now lives, you'll be doing that. You might just be changing the IP on the public internet, because perhaps you're going to change the method of publishing. Maybe you're going from a reverse proxy with pre-authentication just to a load balancer direct on the internet. Maybe it's easier for you guys just to change the DNS record from IP1 to IP2 in that case. And update DNS, of course. And then, once you're done, yes, test it again. Make sure that the changes you just made, give it time for DNS to propagate. Remember, that test is run from Microsoft on data centers first, unless you download the little client version. So you need to give it enough time for DNS to have propagated out in the internet so that when our servers try to run the test for you, they're using the right IP and not going to your old system. You might get a quick clean bill of health and go, hey, that was great, because we used the old IP, not realizing that once DNS is updated, something would have been wrong. All right, and of course, you did this in a lab, right? Everybody in this room has a full lab that looks just like production, right? You're going to do all of it there first. You all promise me, right? This is also the best place where you can go and actually create your certificate. Go in there and go through the certificate wizard in your lab. Do all the names, do everything. You know, create the certificate, get the response back from your CA, import it to your servers, export it with the private key, and now that certificate's perfectly good for going and importing to your production boxes. Very easy to do that there in your lab first, so that night or a couple days before, you're not scrambling to get a new certificate. As I've already mentioned, script this as much as possible. Really, I do mean that. Have two scripts at least. One that's going to set all the values, and one that's going to roll them back just in case. You know, go through again, test it in the lab, have it ready. It's going to change all your virtual directories. It's going to configure your AutoDiscover site scopes if you need to, your URI values with the load balance name if you haven't already done that. Makes it very easy to do this cleanly, once, quickly, and also roll back if necessary. Outlook Anywhere. So I mentioned there'd be a little more detail. This might be your start state, right? You've got Exchange 2010. You're using RPC over HTTP, or Outlook Anywhere for short, or longer, I guess, in that case. All right, you've got your Layer 7 load balancer in place, taking traffic in on mail.contoso.com, and you're getting ready to introduce Exchange 2013. You have an internet-facing site and an intranet-facing site, so it does not have internet access. You'll notice that we have a client access server that is enabled for Outlook Anywhere in the internet-facing site and disabled on the intranet-facing site. So what do we have to do to get ready? The first thing, if you pay attention to the CAS in the intranet-facing site, you'll notice, is that we actually enable Outlook Anywhere on those client access servers, which I know is entirely different from what 2010 and 2007 required. We need this on purpose, because if we do not have Outlook Anywhere enabled, the RPC proxy DLL that's on those boxes will not be running. So we will not be able to proxy connections from 2013 to 2010 or 2007 to get that connection back to their necessary CAS down into their mailbox server. You also want to make sure that in step one, when you give it the Outlook Anywhere hostname, you give it the hostname where you want the traffic to be funneled into, right? So even though on the right-hand side, we might have an internet-facing site with no internet access, I'm still going to put mail.contoso.com as its Outlook Anywhere URL. Why? because that URL is given back from the auto-discover response. So we want to make sure that even though my user is in that other site, he's going to get the proper URL to get proxied through 2013, which might be in the other location. IIS authentication, I'll roll back the animation so you can see it. Pay attention to the client access server in the top left-hand corner. You'll see right now, IIS auth is only basic because we determined when we first enabled OA years ago, we were going to use basic auth. Well, since we don't have NTLM there, we need to also add NTLM for IIS authentication. We need that to be able to proxy the connections using NTLM auth back from 2013, 2000 to 2010 or 7. So we've done two things. We've enabled OA on every CAS in the server, every CAS in the environment, every single one, to make sure AutoDiscover is able to give us the proper values and to make sure that we can proxy through rpcproxy.dll. And we've added NTLM auth for IIS authentication on all the CAS. If you already have just NTLM, that's fine. You don't need to add basic. But if you only have basic, you need to add NTLM. And then there's the DNS switch overnight. Come on. All right, so our DNS cutover. In our case, we're switching over to a layer 4 load balancer with no affinity rules in place. So we're actually switching IPs, so we changed DNS. And now we come through, we hit our 2013 CAS, and it proxies us off to the appropriate location. It'll either proxy to a CAS in the same site for a 2010 user, or it'll proxy directly to a CAS in a non-internet-facing site to get that user to their mailbox server. So relatively straightforward. Make sure OA is enabled everywhere. Make sure it's got the right URL value in place and authentication types. Make sure NTLM is turned on for IIS authentication on all the legacy CAS. And then you're OK to move DNS over to point to 2013. There is a fantastic session coming up on Mapier or HTTP, because that is also some considerations when how to enable it and how to deploy it. Venkat, Rafiq, and Guy will be going through not just the new technology, but also how to deploy it in an environment. I would strongly suggest going to that presentation if you want to learn more about Mapier or HTTP. Publishing. All right, we talked about, I mentioned briefly, reverse proxies and load balancers, et cetera. So whether you want to go learn about which TLA you should choose, three-letter acronym, right? UAG, R, ARR, R, or TMG, et cetera. Greg Taylor will be talking about that. And also you can go see Georg to hear more about WAP and ARR, which are the Microsoft alternatives to TMG and UAG going forward. So let's talk a little bit about Edge. So who's happy Edge is back in 2013? Nice. The hands that went up were very excited. Okay, we're glad you can make you happy. So Edge is back. And when you set up Edge, it's actually extremely simple. There's one, maybe two prerequisites to Edge. You don't have to install nearly as much as you need to on the client access role or the mailbox role. Install the ADLDS feature on server. That's it. Don't go any further. Don't install it and then try to configure it. Edge will actually configure the ADLDS instance for you when you do the installation. It's right there, right? Install Windows feature, ADLDS. If you get this error during setup, you might say, hey, you don't have an FQDN. Well, this box might not be part of a domain. It might just be in a work group because it's on a perimeter network and maybe you don't have a management forest out in the perimeter network. You might get this. So to fix this, you need to actually go into the properties of my computer, go down to the computer name section and then the more section, and you can actually define what the FQDN of that box is going to be. So you can see I have corp.contoso.com in there. Put that guy in. I believe it does require a restart. And then with ADLDS and an FQDN in place, you'll be able to install Edge. What you'll then see, or actually you won't see, is there's no graphical user interface for Edge. So all of your management is actually going to be through PowerShell until you get the Edge subscription in place. To get the Edge subscription in place, just like it was in 2010 and 2007. So you'll log on to your Edge server, you'll launch PowerShell, or I should say you'll launch Exchange Management Shell, and IIS is not running on this box. That's one of the requisites that is not on it, which means we cannot utilize remote PowerShell because there's no PowerShell virtual directory to authenticate and run commands against. So Edge actually has a local instance of Exchange Management Shell, much more similar to what Exchange 2007 had. So you create a new Edge subscription file, very straightforward there, just new Edge subscription, give it a file name, and it's going to create an XML file that, just like in previous versions, you then need to go and import on the mailbox servers. So you'll go to the mailbox servers, and yes, the command is as long and complicated looking as it was in previous versions. You'll give it that XML file. It'll ingest it. It'll start setting up Edge Sync. As long as you can see there, it's got access via TCP 5636 back to the Edge servers, and it can also resolve the name of the Edge servers in DNS. That's commonly missed, right? We installed Edge in a perimeter network, and we never put it in the internal DNS as a host entry, so your mailbox servers have no clue how to get to it. So make sure that's in place. Once you've created that Edge Sync file, Edge subscription file, imported it, Edge Sync will start, and then some of the settings that you would normally expect to be available inside EAC will then show up so that you can manage the Edge that way. There will still be some features that you must log on directly to Edge to manage through PowerShell itself. Once you have all this in place, the Edge server will then show up as part of your organization. So you can see it there. It'll have the Edge role, 847.32 with service pack 1, and you'll be ready to rock and roll there. You'll notice there's two send connectors also created. They have the AD site name that the site you subscribe to. So in this case, it was the Seattle site. So you got Seattle Internet, Internet to Seattle. And you'll notice the source transport server's name is the Edge server itself. That'll remain the name of the first Edge server that you had in place when you created the subscription file. So just a few notes on Edge and mail flow transition itself. So if you have Edge 2007 and 10, they're compatible with 2013 CU1 or later. So that was the temporary state that we had to offer while we still got the work done to get Edge back, which we kind of knew was coming, but we had to give you something temporarily. If you have Edge SP1 in place, you can create an Edge subscription with 2013 SP1, 2010 SP3 RU5, or 2007 SP3 Lucky RU13. So you do need those last couple of RUs for 2007 and 10 to be able to ingest the Edge subscription file that you created on the Edge server itself. excuse me. Just a note again, so as I mentioned earlier, if you apply SP3 on a 2010 box, make sure to redo that subscription so we see the version increment internally. Mail transition. So when do I move my mail flow during my deployment to point to 2013? So this is really one of those things that's entirely up to you and what you feel most comfortable with. But if you do go and deploy 2013 Edge first, you might do it right off the bat. Say, oh, let's start using our 2013 Edge and pass the mail through there, and we can retire our Edge 7 or 10 and move forward with the rest of the deployment. You might leave the MX records pointing at your legacy versions until most of your users are on 13, right? What's the most effective mail route? Well, 80% of my users are still in 2007, 20% are on 13. Probably makes more sense to point the mail flow directly to 7 and let that 20% then find its way over to 2013 later on. Once you cross that 50% barrier, flip the records over. But again, you could do it right at the beginning, right in the middle, when you cross the threshold, or at the end. All are perfectly fine. Edge is a very interesting use case. So if you want to do hybrid mail flow, if you've got a tenant with us, or if you want to purchase EOP standalone, Edge is an excellent option so that you can then have that smooth exchange-to-exchange-to-exchange handoff of mail so that the mail remains part of your organization, the entire path that it takes. Whereas before, some customers didn't like the idea of mail going directly from, say, EOP to their internal network. They wanted it to stop off somewhere, and it wasn't supported to use a non-exchange server in the intermediate path for mail flow. It would break the organizational boundaries and makes all sorts of things happen. So now you can drop Edge out into the perimeter network and pass the mail to your perimeter network first before hitting your internal servers. Let's talk about Kerberos for a few minutes. Who's using Kerberos today with Exchange 2010? Okay, good. Probably relatively large customers that ran into like NTLM bottlenecks, I'm going to guess. So in 2007 and 2003, Kerberos authentication could be used because you were hitting the server object directly. All right, so we'd already had its service principal name for the server object. You could authenticate to it with Kerberos very easily. 2010 made this a bit more difficult because we introduced the client access server RPC array object, and you are now going to a load balance name that wasn't an actual server name. So Kerberos couldn't be used at first. So we introduced the ability to use an alternate service account credential, I think around the service pack 1 timeframe of 2010, so that you could then start using Kerberos authentication once again and get rid of bottlenecks you might see with NTLM that only allows a certain number of secure channel connections back to a domain controller, and the authentications that pass through those channels have to complete one way or another before the next one could come in. So if you're a very large environment with a real huge turnaround of authentication happening, sometimes if you you'd run into those bottlenecks, you could increase them to a certain degree, but it often turned into this trade-off between do we need to deploy more CAS or not. So Kerberos works again in 2013. There's still some caveats that we need to talk about first. So it's there. You can use it under certain conditions. You'll notice that the offline address book virtual directory has already been converted to an app for you. When you first install 2013, it'll be there ready to go. When I say enabling Kerberos, that really means you're turning on negotiate authentication. Now, in 2013, this means two things. It either means Outlook Anywhere, RPC over HTTP, or MAPI over HTTP, now that we have the two connection types. So you might be enabling it for one, for both, et cetera. We'll talk a little bit on how to decide when you would. So to curb or not to curb? We haven't had a lot of guidance on this yet, and at the moment, this is the guidance that we have. If you're a pure 2013 shop, right, you've completed your deployment or you're doing a greenfield, it's okay to enable Kerberos on both the RPC and the MAPI virtual directories. So that's enabling negotiate auth for Outlook Anywhere or set Outlook Anywhere, set client access server with the authentication type, or set MAPI virtual directory with the IIS authentication type set to negotiate. If you're not pure 2013, well, okay, do we have legacy public folders in use or not? Right, because we could be 2013 and 2010, but maybe we don't use public folders. Or we could be 13, 10, and 7, and we do use public folders on 2007, or we don't, et cetera. So there's a lot of combinations here. But most easily stated, if we're not using public folders, legacy public folders, sorry, go ahead and enable Kerberos. Go through the steps to get it enabled. If we are using legacy public folders, you'll notice something up there that doesn't make sense quite yet. Do you have CU5 deployed? Currently, the authentication teams are working on, and they hope, and notice the big red asterisk there, we're hoping that come CU5, you'll actually be able to enable Kerberos regardless of the fact if you're using legacy public folders or not. What happens, I got a woohoo out of the audience somewhere. Nice. So what happens is when you create your profile and you're getting auto-discover responses back, there's no way currently to tell Outlook, hey, look, for your primary mailbox, use News Negotiate, and for your public folder connection, use NTLM or BASIC. Because 2007 or 10 didn't understand what Negotiate meant for an Outlook Anywhere connection, which is what they're going to see coming from a 13 user. A 13 user isn't going to get back RPC settings in their auto-discover response because their primary mailbox is on 13. So we're hoping, and again, the story could change, but I just want to let you know, we're hoping that in CU5 we'll be able to make this so that when auto-discover gives a response back, we can tell the client to use two different authentication types depending on what resource they're using. Whereas, say, like a shared mailbox kicks off an auto-discover request. So you get a shared mailbox's SMTP value back, and then we do another auto-discover query, and we can figure out what settings to use. A public folder connection doesn't initiate that other auto-discover query. So if you have CU5, and again, it's not a promise, it's a hope, right? Plans change. You could enable Kerberos for RPC and MAPI. If you end up with no other options here, you could migrate your public folders to 2013, which, as you guys may know, that's the last thing that gets migrated. So that would mean all your users have been migrated to 13, and then you migrate your public folders to 13. You could then go back, reevaluate, and say, yep, okay, now we don't have legacy public folders. We could enable Kerberos. So we'll be doing a little more documentation on this and probably putting up a blog article to help walk you through the different scenarios in the not-too-distant future. If you have a pretty complex environment, you could have a mess like this inside of the connection status window in Outlook, right? I've got a 2013 primary mailbox using Kerberos. I've got 2007 public folders using NTLM. I've got a 2010 shared mailbox using NTLM and a 2013 shared mailbox using the negotiate auth, Kerberos, which you could verify using the KList utility to see if you had a Kerberos ticket for that URL. So it can start to get quite complex when you get all the versions in a single organization, as well as legacy public folders and all sorts of connection types. We only need the HTTP service principal names now. You no longer need the other guys. You don't need the Exchange AB, the Exchange RFR, or the Exchange MDB SPNs. Right, so if you're only using a certain ASA account for 2013, it's just going to look very similar to what you see on the screen there. You'll just have the HTTP SPNs for the URLs that you require. If you're sharing an ASA account with 2010, it would look different, right? We'd have to add the other SPN values in for the 2010 servers as well. But if it was an ASA only used for 2013, It'll look kind of like this. What options do we have? Reuse the 2010 Alternate Service Account credential, if one exists. Maybe you never deployed one. Problem is, there's going to be new human known credentials here. And I'll get into why that is in a second. So nice thing would be you have a single ASA shared across 2010 and 2013, but now the credentials are known to an administrator inside the organization. Alternatively, you could create a new ASA for 2013. One of the pros that we'll talk about on the next slide is you can now use the role alternate service account password script to create that new ASA. Con would be you have to then work with the AD guys to move a few SPNs from the 2010 ASA, if one exists, to the 2013 ASA. Because you probably would have already had the HTTP SPNs on the 2010 ASA account. How's that for acronyms? So you now have to go and move those SPNs to the new ASA account. Because in Active Directory, you're not allowed to have the same SPN on two different accounts at the same time. So it's a little bit of juggling, but it works out relatively easy. There's commandlets that you can use to force the replication partners very quickly inside Active Directory to make sure that when you move these SPNs, it's as fast as possible, and then you can move your namespace over to 2013 and be able to use Kerberos immediately. So the caveats today, and these are things that we're working on making better. I can't make any promises on timelines or what's going to happen specifically. At the moment, you cannot use the role alternate service account password script to copy the existing credentials from 2010 to 2013. It just won't work. You get a nice big ugly red error message. You also can't use it to create an ASA on a CAS-only server. So currently, the script itself only works on multi-role boxes, partially because of the next item. The set client access server commandlet with the alternate service account credential switch currently only works on multi-role servers. So we're doing some investigation. We've already had a couple folks ask us about this. We're looking into what we need to do to make this a better story so that if you've chosen to do a single role installation of CAS only, you'd be able to deploy Kerberos there as well. So more to come on that later. Public folders, which I'm not going to go too deep into because I think we have three sessions this week. That you can go learn a lot more about migrations and how they work, et cetera, with a lot of the folks that are here this week. They are the last thing that you migrate, so you have to move all your users over to 2013. Technically speaking, it's all your public folder using users. But they all have to be at 2013 before you can migrate to public folders because a 2013 user can access the down-level versions, but not the other way around. A 2007 or 10 user cannot access the 2013 public folders. It is a cutover migration. So there is a night where you throw the big red switch and force everybody to start using 2013's public folders once the data synchronization and hierarchy sync has been completed. But there are more on that with the sessions that I've got here. I think I've got two of the three. So if you want to learn more about migrations themselves, on-premises and Office 365, go see Kanika and Siggy's talk on later this afternoon, actually, later today. And then there's going to be a session tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. We're all bright-eyed and bushy-tailed after the party tonight on a public folder experts unplug session. So we've got Alphonse, Kanika, Sashi, Siggy, and myself will be there to take any questions you might have related to public folders. Offline address books. Now, we talked earlier in the talk about making sure that we define the older offline address book as the default OAB for our legacy databases before installing the first 2013 servers. All right, so we do that before we even get to this point. It's possible in 2013, due to the new architecture of offline address book generation, distribution, and download, that you could have multiple arbitration mailboxes with offline address book generation capability. Up there on the screen is the command that you can use to find what they are. All right, so you get mailbox arbitration, pipe that out to a where clause that is looking for the persisted capabilities like star OAB star, and then give me all the mailboxes. So in my lab, I had two. One was the default one created, and one was one that I created on my own called OAB Gen 2. Both of those arbitration mailboxes are creating offline address books inside of them. Let's say I had 500 offline address books in my organization. Each one creates all 500. Okay, so there's no way to currently to say, you create these 250 and you create these 250 offline address books. They just both go nuts creating all 500 each. And while they're generating them, you know, at certain intervals, they're not quite generated at the exact same time. So even though it's the same OAB, it's the same GUID even of the OAB itself, you know, the differential files that get created, The original system mailbox might create its offline address book differential file at, let's say, 12:30 p.m. And OIB Gen 2, maybe it created the differential file for that offline address book at 12:35 p.m., just because that's how their timing was. There could have been changes in Active Directory in those five-minute delta of time, which means the generated differential file for the same offline address book is not the same in each OIB generating mailbox. And what that happens is that if my Outlook client downloads the OIB from server one that has the system mailbox in it, and then tomorrow I download the OIB from mailbox server two that's got OIB Gen 2 in it, even though it's the same OIB, the differential files don't match up. Okay, they're not going to match up. It would result in a corrupt OIB and a full download would be triggered. So remember, like I said at Microsoft, that would mean that potentially, let's say I just hopscotched every other day. Luck of the draw. Day one, I get server one. Day two, I get server two. Day three, I get server one, et cetera, to infinity. I would be downloading 700 megs of OIBs every single day. It can add up quick. So how does this happen? So you could have the multiple offline address books. You might have even separated them to different sites. So I've got my two offline address books on the upper right. We can see that they're in two different databases. We can then look and see in this particular lab, I didn't have a DAG set up, so I could see that the two different databases were actually on two different servers. And going further, I could see that the two different servers are in two different Active Directory sites. It's pretty well separated, right? But when you stop and think about it, you could have something like this with a DAG that spans both sites. And if you're in an active-active topology and you don't really care if the databases mount in one site or the other, they move around due to maintenance and whatnot, that means that in this case, my little orange file folders are OIB Gen 1 mailbox. He's creating his offline address books. OIB Gen 2 in the blue file folders is creating its offline address books. So I've got site resiliency, right, because I've got a generation on each side. And I've even got local site resiliency because I've got multiple copies of the database that each offline address book are in. Well, what happens now if the databases move from one site to another? You can see where I'm going with this, right? I'm running out of my primary site on Monday, things are good, and then all of a sudden on Tuesday, we do a switchover test, and all my users hit the different generation mailbox and start downloading the offline address book all over again. So the current recommendation is to do this. And we are looking at ways to potentially make this better, but I just want to let you know what we're currently recommending. Is even as of SP1, just have a single OIB Gen mailbox in the organization as a whole, worldwide. Right? You could do the top option, which is you've got local site resiliency, but you have no site resiliency. So we'd really suggest the second option there. Have an OIB Gen mailbox that is inside a database replicated and the two different Active Directory sites that your DAG spans. If you've got If you've got more than two sites, a whole bunch of locations, you really need to go to the whiteboard and draw it all out and say, okay, here's all of our different Active Directory sites. Let's make sure that wherever we put OIB Gen mailboxes, they don't overlap as far as where users could move mailboxes back and forth. Because you might have 6, 12 Active Directory sites, and they have DAGs that are entirely independent of each other, and their users never come from the same Active Directory sites. Maybe then you might have more than one offline address book generating arbitration mailbox. But for most people, we think just having the single mailbox is okay for now. And there's no more distribution. We don't copy the offline address book, say, to CAS like we used to in 2007 or 10. Now when a client connection comes in requesting the offline address book, the CAS will proxy the connection back to mailbox, which will go and grab the offline address book out of one of two options. If no one's gotten it lately and there's a old version on disk, it'll spit it out of the arbitration mailbox onto disk and then copy it right from there. If the next user comes in behind him, well, we have a fresh copy sitting on disk, so we'll just grab it right there off a disk on the mailbox server and send it out to the user. Quota calculations. So quota calculations changed a bit in 2013. You may or may not have seen the article on the blog we had about this. But when you look at a mailbox in 2010 or 2007, let's just say it's a 20 gig mailbox. What is most likely going to happen, or I should say will happen to some degree, is that when you move it to 2013, you're going to see the reported size increase. The reason for this is that we learned that in 2010, we weren't necessarily taking account of all the different attributes that a message has inside of a mailbox. So we were looking at a certain number of attributes, and maybe that message added up to 5 megs in size. when we looked at all the attributes of the message, we looked at the entire footprint of that message inside the database, that message was actually taking up more like 6, 7, maybe even 8 megs of space, right? Which meant that when you're doing trending as far as storage usage, your metrics are off. You're watching the mailbox quotas get bigger, but you're noticing that on disk, your database is actually getting even bigger. What was going on there? So the decision was made by the store team that in 2013, we're going to do a much better job of actually calculating the true usage of a mailbox's stamp inside of the database. So if you take that 20 gig mailbox from 2007 or 10, move it over to 2013, you're probably going to see it grow 30 to 40%. It's a rough number. That's the observations that we've seen as we went through our Office 365 and our Microsoft migrations. What I'd really suggest is that you also consider maybe in our pilot moves, right, we're going to move 500,000 people, whatever it is. Take a look. See if that 30 to 40% is holding true for your own users, or are you in a business type that is certain mail formats, you know, HTML, plain text, MIME, et cetera, attachment types, depending on what they are. See if your mailbox types actually grow less, 10%, 15%, or grow more. We've seen it even be larger. So it is something you need to be aware of. You might find that a user that's kind of hanging around that, say the 30 to 40 actually plays true for you in your environment, you might find a user that is kind of at that 70, 75% used quota today. When you move them, there's a strong possibility they might suddenly be over 100%. And now they can't get mail or they can't send mail depending on how you've defined your quotas inside the organization. So do a report before you do the migration. This is a very easy one to miss, right? Just do a report, see, okay, we got everybody's at like 50, 60%, we should be good. Oh, shoot, you know, it's always going to be the executive board, right? They're at like 85. And if we hadn't looked at them in beforehand, you know, we would have basically blown up their mailboxes and then they'd get no new mail. So, all right, so maybe we'll increase their quota a little bit and move them over to 2013. That'll be the intermediate step. We had to do the same step in Office 365 when we were going from wave 14 to 15. We had some users really high up at their quota levels, so we had to give them a small bump to get them over the hump into the Wave 15 service. And with that, we wanted to end on hopefully a good note. There's been a lot of people asking for certificate-based authentication for ActiveSync. Look at that. Wow, nice. Even if it's pity applause, that's great. But it's coming back in CU5, so we will have that. We know that's been a deployment blocker for some folks. I think Service Pack 1 brought back CBA for OAuth. We'll now have it back for ActiveSync. We've got the testing done with the ActiveSync folks to make sure that that's in place and ready for you guys to rock and roll with once CU5 comes out. So with that, that's the end of this presentation. Pre-release. Go see my friends Reed Lee and Dave Espinoza down in the hall. If you want to get access to the next version of Exchange before it is released, or maybe even in the service itself, our team, the customer adoption team, is the one responsible for all the pre-release programs. You've heard them called TAP in the past. If that's something that interests you and your company likes the idea of running pre-production code in their deployment environment to test things out and have the newest bells and whistles, go see Dave, talk to him. I'll be around for the rest of the week. I'll be at the party tonight. And the other events, please do fill out the evals. We appreciate them. Positive remarks, negative remarks, let us know what you thought of everything. This is your conference. We want to make sure you guys get the most out of it. So thank you very much. Enjoy the rest of the week. I'll be around.